The Association of Classical and Christian Schools presents Repairing the Runes, the 2018 ACCS Annual Conference, copyright 2018. You may make additional copies of this recording for use by your school, but please do not sell any copies of the recording. Learn more about classical Christian education and ACCS at classicalchristian.org.
All right, good afternoon. My name is Josh Simmons. I'm the associate head of the Rhetoric School at Regents School of Austin. It's a new position for me. The last 3 years, I've been the head of our humanities department there. And so I'm excited to have you here. We're going to talk about backwards curriculum design, a concept frequently called UBD, or understanding by design. I'll be using those types of terms kind of synonymously. We'll talk about that, and then we'll go forward from there, and hopefully have the chance to give you some questions at the end. So let's open in prayer, and then we'll get started. Heavenly Father, thank you for the opportunity we have to be here in this conference, for the opportunity to renew our minds, renew our visions for our schools, and may we get greater clarity about how to accomplish what we want to accomplish for our students, to give our students and our families the best possible opportunities that we can in terms of education, so that they may be better servants of you and of your kingdom as they go forward. We ask this in Christ's name. Amen. All right, backwards design is a pretty simple concept in a lot of ways. I'm not going to have a PowerPoint presentation. I don't like it with my teachers to use PowerPoint presentations, so I'm not going to do it myself either. So backwards design basically just means starting whatever you're doing with the end goal in mind. Okay, it sounds like a really simple concept. Start with the end in mind, figure out what that thing is you want to do, and then go from there. But it's definitely easier said than done. It takes a lot of thought and effort to do that. It's a lot easier to just be like, well, we're going to read these books, and then we'll kind of figure out where we get to at the end. Right? But starting with the end in mind is kind of the idea behind backwards design. You know, so what that means is we have to have a real clear vision in our own minds of what a successful graduate will look like. What are the skills? What are the habits? What's the knowledge? What are the aesthetic desires or values that they have? Understandings, you know, those types of things. Faith values, you know, faith understandings. All those types of things are all things that are part of what we're trying to do as a school, and that we need to kind of say, this is what we want to accomplish. So that if someone spent, you know, if we're a K-12 school, if they spent 13 years in our academic program, what should they look like? You know, it shouldn't be an accident that they come out looking a certain way if we've spent 13 years pouring into them. We shouldn't be like, oh, I hope they love Jesus at the end of this, or I hope they know something. Right? We need to tailor our curriculum to give, you know, so they're coming out as best as we can with what we want them to come out with. Now, if there's a role of the Holy Spirit in this, we can't create faith in people. Right? We can provide seeds and opportunities for them, though, to go forward going on from there. So then the question becomes, and once we know and real clearly know what we're trying to accomplish, and I would say as a school, we'll talk about this a little bit more specifically here in a second, but it's really important to use common language for this. You know, don't use big words that people aren't going to really understand. You want your parent community, you want your new teachers who are coming in to know really clearly what it is you're trying to accomplish, what that graduate, that kind of ideal end product looks like. And then once we know what that is, then we begin to kind of backfill back in and say, okay, well, how do we go about doing that? What are the steps that are necessary to take us from, you know, this little, you know, snot-nosed seventh grader who can't stop punching the kid next to him into someone who we're proud of as an 18-year-old, you know, young man going off into the world? And now, one of the things that I really like about the understanding by design approach is that it's entirely scalable. Right? It's applicable at the school-wide level. It's applicable at the daily level. Right? And just to give you kind of a model of this, I'm going to say I've got kind of three goals for today. So this will be kind of your starting with the end in mind. What are the things I want you to take out of here at the end of our 45 minutes together? Okay. First, I want you to understand what the basic principles of understanding by design are. What does that mean when people use that? What are some of the key terms that go along with that? Second, I want to give you some questions to be asking yourselves and your schools and your boards about kind of what are we trying to do here? How are we accomplishing what we're trying to do? So you give kind of some questions for thought. And then finally, some kind of practical means of applying these UBD principles into our schools. So I say it's scalable, right? I mean, at the end of the day, it starts with the vision of the school. What are we here for? What's our mission statement? Why are we doing what we're trying to do? That's really kind of the core thing. But it could be applicable to fine arts. Why do we have a fine arts program? What are we trying to accomplish with our fine arts program? Do we want them to become, you know, the next, you know, Monet or the next Renoir? Are we trying to, you know, just give them the opportunity to play with different environments, you know, those types of things? About our athletics departments, why do we have one? How does it fit into the vision of the school? But it's also applicable at like a division scale, you know? As a high school, what is our goal? Like, what are we trying to do with our 4 years that we have? It could be applicable at the grade level, you know? So we have ninth graders. At the end of ninth grade, what are the things that we want them to be able to walk away from as they go forward into 10th grade? It's applicable at the department level. You know, as a humanities department, what are the things that we want our students, after 4 years of our study, to walk away from having? You know, maybe it's books that they've read, maybe it's characters that they've met, but maybe it's also reading skills, ability to interpret information, ability to read poetry and get something, you know, of value and meaning out of it. It's applicable at the course level. You know, why do these students take ancient and classical history and literature? What's the point of this? What are we trying to get out of it at the end of the day? It's applicable at the unit level, and then it's applicable even at the day level. You know, what's the goal? What's the takeaway for today for them to walk away? And so the goal of this then is to, I'd say, to intentionally try to create or cultivate habits, skills, knowledges, responses, and understandings in our students. That's really what we're trying to do here. All right, intentionally trying to create specific habits, skills, knowledge, responses, and understandings. And so the types of questions to be asking here at the very, very beginning are things like these, right? What are we doing here, right? What's the purpose of this school? What's the purpose of this class that I'm teaching? What's the purpose of anything that we're doing? What are we doing? Right, what are we trying to accomplish? And then the next question that comes along that I think we oftentimes forget, but it's a really key question, is how will we know if we've achieved that goal or not? Right, this gets us into the question of assessment. You know, so as a teacher in the class, right, I need to know, have my students learn this material? So I give them a test or an assessment of some kind, and they give me information back that tells me how well they've learned this material. But for them, at a school level, though, it gets a little bit harder. Are we actually delivering the mission that we say that we're delivering? How would we know? You know, and so that gets into kind of some difficult questions there. You know, and then this question here is one that I like a lot, but what are the qualities that an excellent student at our school possesses? All right, so if you think about an excellent student at your school, one who does really well, kind of embodies a lot of who you are as an institution, what are they doing? Who are they? What's their character like? What's their educational philosophy like? How do they spend their time? Those types of things. And then ask, are those things that we can help other students become like that? Right? It didn't just happen that way. There's things that we can do to help them going forward. So when it comes to the concept of understanding by design, here you'll probably want to move over to the bottom right if you're taking notes in the thing. The spacing on the outline's a little wonky here. I want to give you kind of an overview of the kind of key ideas of understanding by design here. So the first step that gets talked about in this is that you need to come up with what are called established goals. That's kind of the general terminology. So this is like the highest level of things that establish kind of what we're trying to do. So you don't want to necessarily turn teachers completely loose and be like, hey, you're teaching the Iliad, go to it. Right? You need to have some guidance or direction so they know how that fits into the broader scope of whatever course it's part of the school curriculum, school culture, that type of thing. And so these are the kind of like, you know, the goals of the school that this particular unit or course are designed to help you accomplish. Right? Because every class in the school should be working together towards some end that you've defined. And so how is this particular class helping you accomplish that end? What is it doing? You know, in some cases, it might be really explicit, like, you know, we take Algebra 2 because it's required by the state standards that all students have to take this class. That could be an established goal for you. But there might be other reasons there, too. I would strongly encourage administrators to write those, Don't leave those up to teachers to write. Have somebody at a high level write those established goals and saying, this is what we're doing for this course, and then teachers can then kind of pick and choose based upon, okay, so if I'm in this particular unit, this unit is helping me accomplish this goal for this course. But they don't have to come up and articulate that language on their own. So that's, again, it's kind of the highest level. These are the goals that kind of we're trying to work towards to accomplish. The next kind of level down below that are what are typically called enduring understandings. Enduring understandings. And these are core concepts or beliefs stated as generalizations based upon experience or facts. Okay. So, like, for example, if I'm teaching a geometry class, and let's say these kids are really behind for some reason, and I start showing them a whole bunch of these, like, things that have kind of three sides, right, but they're different. Some of them are small, some of them are big, some have acute angles, some have obtuse, some are 90-degree angles. And I begin to kind of tease this out with them. I begin to say, okay, what do all these things have in common? They might be like, all these things have three sides. And we'd be like, okay, so the enduring understanding would be all triangles have three sides. Doesn't matter how big they are, doesn't matter the size, doesn't matter the angles, those types of things. But it's best for most students if they figure that out on their own. Right? If you don't give that to them, but you need to know as a teacher what you're trying to accomplish to get them there, but don't give it to them kind of on their own. Now, as a general rule, there are two types of these enduring understandings. There are understandings we would call general, right? And then the ones that are sort of topical or specific. So a general understanding might be something like, revolutions always eat their own. Now, revolutions always eat their own. This could be true of the Russian Revolution, it could be true of the French Revolution, could be true of all sorts of revolutions throughout history, that the people who start revolutions very rarely stick around to finish it. Okay? Now, that would be a general principle. Now, a specific or topical one might be like, the people who started the French Revolution in 1789 did not see the rise of Napoleon in 1799. Most of them. There's a couple of exceptions, but most of them didn't. Okay. So then now I've got a specific thing about this specific revolution. But those are the kind of understandings that work. At a big picture level, we want to be looking at kind of that general level. But these are things, again, teachers should know. This is what I'm trying to get my students to be able to articulate. These are truths, things that are of value, that are important, that this is why we're doing this course. This is why we're doing this course of study, is to get them to understand those core concepts. To help with that is kind of another thing that goes along with this, which are called essential questions. And these are the kind of entrance questions to those core ideas. Okay? So these are questions that teachers should come up with to basically be like, okay, if I want them to get to be where they can articulate this enduring understanding I've got over here, what are the types of questions I'm going to need to ask to get me there and to get them there ultimately, right? Because it doesn't do them any good if you know everything, but they can't grasp it themselves. So again, these also tend to exist in kind of two ways. There's sort of an overarching questions and then kind of topical, specific questions. So an overarching type of question might be like, you know, in what way does art both reflect and influence the culture that surrounds it? Okay? So if you're dealing with like an art history class, or if you have a class that does a lot of like art in its studies, you know, that would be an interesting question to have, is like, over this whole period of time, we're going to be looking at all sorts of examples of ways that art influences and then helps create and shape the culture that's around it. We're going to see all sorts of examples of that. You know, a more specific or topical question might be something like, how does St. Peter's in Rome show the Baroque Counter-Reformation? Right? Now we're getting into kind of a very specific, very particular situation going on there. The next kind of step down, as we're moving from kind of abstract to concrete in terms of idea, are a category called students will know. Students will know. And these are, I would say, specific facts that the student is going to need to know to be able to access those enduring understandings. Okay, if you're trying to get them to understand this truth that's out there, whatever that is, there's going to be certain, maybe it's vocabulary, maybe it's events, maybe it's people, that they're going to need to know in order to be able to have a conversation or to understand what's going on. Right, you don't want kids who can go around talking about the French Revolution, but they can't tell you anything about who Robespierre is. They need to have certain information. And then this raises the question about, well, how are they going to get this information? Right? Is it stuff that it might be stuff that they've learned already. Maybe this is pre-knowledge that they have coming in, but that they're going to be specifically asked to rely upon this. This is particularly true in like language classes, math classes, science classes, classes that really build on what's come beforehand to get to the present. But it also, like in a history class particularly, it might be, well, you have to provide this information for them. So how are you going to do it? Are you going to do it through a reading? Are you going to do it through a lecture? Are you going to do it through a video? All right, there's all sorts of different methods of giving them this information that they need. Then the other aspect to that is, so if we want students to know these things, they also need to be able to do certain things. So it's kind of this mind-body factor here. So what are the things that they're going to need to be able to do to get this? Now, it might be as simple as they're going to need to be able to read, right? We have this homework reading tonight. They're going to need to be able to read this information. It's, you know, 10 pages about the Reformation. They're going to need to be able to read it and understand who the key figures are. You know, so maybe they're going to need to be able to take notes. Right? They're going to need to be able to highlight if they can do that in their book. They're going to need to have some skill level to be able to gather that information so when they bring it to class the next day, they can actually do something with it. But this also could be, at the end of this unit, they're going to be writing a paper, maybe, let's say. So then at the end of this unit, they're going to be writing a paper, so now I need to figure out, well, are they capable? Do they have the skills necessary to write the type of paper that I want them to write? Maybe there's some aspect of, I need to teach them a certain level of research ability so that they can go and find this information. But that's stuff that, again, they're just not going to naturally arrive on your doorstep with. That has to be taught and programmed into what you're doing as a school. So those are kind of the core aspects there. So we've got these kind of like ideas at the top, the goals of the school that you're trying to accomplish, and then how is this particular course or this particular unit helping accomplish those goals? And then what are those core ideas, those enduring understandings, that you want the students to sort of be taking away, whether it's a unit or a daily lesson plan, or again, could be at the course or even the school level. So I want to get out of the abstract a little bit and get into a little bit more concrete stuff here. So at Regents, we have carved on the outside of our rhetoric building this statement by Quintilian that says, you know, the good man speaking well. That's kind of, I would say, a shorthand for our mission statement, which is the idea of giving students a Christian worldview and helping them learn to love, know, and practice that which is true, good, and beautiful. Okay, so if that's kind of what we're trying to do, that's our mission statement, that's our goal, that's what we're trying to accomplish as a school, then we have to ask the questions, how are we doing that, right? And then this raises all sorts of other questions, because then we get questions of like definition. So if we're talking about the good man speaking well, what does it mean to be good, right? How would we know if our students are good, right? Is it the type of thing where it's like, oh, we've had, you know, the number of police reports of our students has declined rapidly over the last 5 years, therefore they're getting better. They're better people now. Maybe they're just better criminals, right? There could be different things going on there, and this gets to where it's difficult to make some of these assessments here. But, you know, so some of the questions that we need to be asking for us, and I think you can think through this for your own school here, is, yeah, so what does it mean to be good, and how do we assess that? That's really hard, right? Those are the things that we really value. We want virtue. We want goodness in our students. But how do you assess that in the classroom? You know, so part of that definition, the good man speaking well. Do we give students the opportunities to practice their speaking abilities, right? If our goal is to have people who can speak well, but we never give them the opportunity to speak, we're unlikely to accomplish the goal of having people who can speak well. We have to give them opportunities. And then speaking involves a wide variety of things, right? It's not always, in fact, it very rarely, in most of our lives, it's very rarely somebody doing what I'm doing right now, getting up and talking to a group of people who are listening, right? Most of our communication happens in small groups, in informal settings, in discussions with friends, sitting around the dinner table, things like that. Are we preparing them for opportunities like that? Are they getting opportunities to do those types of things? You know, where in the curriculum are they getting the chance to practice these skills that we're saying this is core to who we are and what we're trying to create in our graduate? You know, so when we come back to the idea of good, right, you know, we think ultimately, of course, we're talking about within the realm of the Christian worldview. Do we give them opportunities to express their understanding of the Christian worldview? Where do we do that? Is that only within like our theology classes, or does it show up in our science classes, our math classes, our history classes? Do we give students the opportunity to wrestle with these, with their faith, right? Because at the end of the day, they have to take ownership over. That's a key idea with understanding as opposed to like knowledge, if you want to make a distinction between those things. Knowledge is you've given me information and I can then repeat it back to you, right? That doesn't actually mean I understand. Understanding is when I've taken it in, I've moved it from my head maybe to my heart, and now I get it. I've connected it this way. One of the other things I do at Regents is I lead our trip to Europe every year with our juniors. And one of my favorite things on that trip is seeing them. It happens most at the Louvre, but they'll look at a piece of art that we haven't gone over in class, and they'll be like, that's Romanticism. I'll be like, you're right. How do you know? And then they'll start going through the different features of Romanticism that we went over in class weeks ago and saying, I recognize these features here in this new piece. That's understanding, because now they've taken it from something kind of abstract where they're just regurgitating it to I can recognize the features in a piece that I've never seen. And oh, look, here's another piece over here that has those same features. And then sometimes they'll be like, I don't know about this piece. It seems like it's got some aspects of it, but maybe there's some neoclassical going on here. What do you think? And we can talk through that. But that's getting to that issue of kind of understanding, where they're truly grasping the concept, not just able to sort of recognize a piece of art and be like, oh, we've gone over in that class. That's the one with the, you know, the guys on the raft. It's Romanticism. You know, that type of thing. We don't. And that's good, but we want to move past that to this kind of deep understanding where they take ownership of their learning. All right, so I want to talk briefly now about some examples, kind of. So I've got this broken down. This is under Roman numeral 3 there. How are we doing time-wise? So I'm doing this kind of backwards from the unit up to kind of the school-wide level here, just because I think for most teachers, this is how they tend to think. And so at the unit level, like I said, this UBD approach is very scalable. You know, at the unit level, the core question is, what do I want my students to get out of this unit? So this unit might be 3 weeks long about a particular subject. So maybe it's like, we're doing a 3-week unit on the Renaissance. So I need to ask them, what are those things at the end of these 3 weeks that I want my students to know about the Renaissance? Maybe it's certain figures, maybe it's pieces of art, maybe it's kind of core concepts like humanism or the distinction between the Northern Renaissance and the Italian Renaissance, all those type of things. Could be a wide variety of things depending upon the age of the students, right, and how much they've gotten of this before and that type of thing. But that's kind of the core question there. And then I also need to ask myself, and again, this is where as administrators, it's really helpful to help teachers out with this, is how does this particular unit fit into the bigger goals of the school? Right, because as teachers, oftentimes it's easy to get kind of like silo focused. Right, this is my class. It happens here. It's kind of doing its own thing, and it may be disconnected from stuff that's going on in other classes. But ultimately, because we believe, right, God is the center of all things. He's the source of all truth. Everything we're doing, whether it's math, science, history, Latin, whatever it is, should be centered around and point back to God. Right? It should be connected that way. So our schools should model that. And then also, you know, how will I know that students understand the core ideas of this unit? This gets us to assessment. In UBD principles, they typically say assessment is the second thing you do. Right? So figure out what you're trying to accomplish, then figure out how you're going to assess it. Right? And assessment may look different. Like, so for example, in apologetics at our school, we have a unit on the problem of evil. We say, okay, we're going to spend a lot of time, this is the big issue within Christian apologetics, is, you know, why do bad things happen, basically? If God is good and he's all-powerful, why are there evil things in the world? And we spend a lot of time going through this issue with them, talking to them about how do you respond to this rationally, but also helping them recognize that the problem of evil is really, on most levels, it's an emotional issue, right? Why is my sister dying here? Why didn't God stop that from happening? It hits us at the gut level, not really at the mind level. And so when we were developing this unit and we started thinking, well, how do we assess our students over, do they actually understand this? The way we came up to assess it is we told them, you're going to write a letter. A friend of yours has come to you and their neighbor's daughter has just been diagnosed with terminal cancer. Right? And they're asking you for advice about how to respond to this. You know, their neighbor's heartbroken over this. They're devastated. They're wondering, where is God? And this person is coming to you and is like, help me out. All right, so now the students have to then be like, okay, take what they've learned in class and now apply it to a particular situation. Do they demonstrate empathy in this? This is a terrible situation. We don't want to just go into like apologetics robot mode and be like, you know, God is in control of all things will work together for his good, you know, and glory. Right? That's true, but that doesn't really connect with that grieving mother at that point in time. So they have to demonstrate empathy and sympathy in their writing of this. They also have to demonstrate they understand why the problem of evil is a problem for Christian theology, and then how they would respond to that. And that's all part of this assessment. But it didn't look like for their, like, if you were to ask my apologetic students this past year, we had no tests in the class this year because we didn't have anything that looked like a traditional test because we kept trying to get back to things like, well, what is this, what are we actually trying to assess here? And does just having them, you know, do a multiple choice test where it's like, oh, do you recognize the problem of evil as stated here? That doesn't actually show us whether they understand it or they understand how to respond to it. So at the course level then, so if we step back from the unit level and look, think about the, what we're doing as a course, okay? Why are students taking this course, right? This is a question that I think every one of your teachers should be able to answer for their course. A few years ago, I had all my literature teachers write a one-paragraph apologia for every book that they taught. Like, because at some point over the course of the year, some student is going to come to you and be like, why are we reading this book? And you need to be able to explain it to them. This is why we read this book. Of all the possible works of literature, we've picked these handful out, and this is why, in particular, we chose this one, and this is what you should be trying to get out of it. In many cases, I mean, whether that question ever comes up or not, it helps the teacher begin to think through, well, these books aren't just being sort of like given to me like, you know, Moses receiving the Ten Commandments, and I have to do them. There's reasons behind them, and I have to kind of bring those things together and connect them all together. So why are students taking this course is a good thing for students, for teachers to have to answer. You know, and then how does this course fit into the broader goals of the department, of the school, and how could a student best demonstrate understanding of the key ideas or skills of this class? So again, to take this apologetics course that I taught. At the end of the day, right, the goal of apologetics is to help students understand the gospel, know how to defend the gospel against basic objections to the Christian faith that they're likely to encounter, and then give them the opportunity to develop the Christian worldview in argumentation about Christian topics. Now, this is going to set the stage for their senior thesis the following year, where they're going to be dealing with Christian worldview argumentation at a wider array of topics, topics that come across as, you know, secular or not like explicitly connected to the Christian faith like we do in apologetics. So we're kind of building towards that next thing at the thesis level. But that's what we're trying to accomplish here in this class. And so one of the things we had students do right towards the end of class in apologetics, again, we're getting to this issue of assessment, is as I gave them a chance, I said, you need to write a 30 to 60 second monologue or speech, basically, explaining why you're a Christian. You know? And then I took them out into the woods on our campus, and I accosted them periodically. I'd be like, how can you be a Christian? You're smart. You think, you know, you're telling me you believe there's some like fairy god up there who's making everything happen? And tried to force them to articulate this thing that they'd had a chance to write. And the ones who did well, they then started to come back with questions at me. Some got really defensive and were like, well, you know, you can kind of believe what you want. But some were like, well, why do you think this? You know, based upon, again, this is the scope of the course as a whole. And it gave me a chance to sort of see them in action. And one of my kind of favorite moments in this course was right at the very end. A student came to me. And he goes, you know, I was at AutoZone yesterday with my dad, and this guy was wearing this cross necklace, and we started kind of having this conversation. I realized, like, this is what we've been doing in apologetics. This is, like, I'm prepared for this conversation that's happening right now. And he was upset that he hadn't handled it as well as he thought he should have. But I think the very fact that he was aware that this was an opportunity for him to dialogue with this person that he wouldn't normally not have seen, that's moving towards understanding, right? He's understanding what we're trying to do with the course as a whole. Prepare them, because it's not about, you know, I'm writing this book on apologetics or apologetics. Apologetics exists in reality, right? It exists in interpersonal relationships all the time. So that's kind of what we're trying to do with that course as a whole. Now, at the department level, you know, with the humanities department, we have a humanities department handbook, and the first two pages of that are basically a, what is the role of the humanities department in the broader school at Regents? You know, and our goal is to help students read well, write well, think well, and speak well, basically. That's what we're doing. You know, we are not responsible for giving them kind of an objective view of the world. That's math science. They handle that. We handle the more subjective side of things. How do people respond to the situations that they find themselves in? Because that's, we're all people, right? This is all us. We can connect with these things. And then at the school level, you know, what are we doing as a school, and how do we know that we've succeeded? At Regents, I think the ultimate way we test this, and this is a classical approach to things, is through the senior thesis. Right? The senior thesis exists as a capstone program to basically demonstrate, have they learned what they're supposed to be learning over the course of their studies? You know, we want them to be able to think well, to understand the difference between fact and opinion. Can they do that? Can they stand up in front of an audience and give a well-presented presentation that they've argued and they've thought through and they've debated and discussed? And then can they think quickly on their feet when the judges are asking them questions, challenging them on certain things? Right? And so the whole scope of our kind of program as a whole is kind of embodied in that thesis moment for those kids. And so that's where we take, again, like I said in the apologetics, that Christian worldview and argumentation, and now we're applying it to a wide range of topics. So I want to talk briefly now about backward design and the board, and then backward design and administrators, kind of how board members and administrators can approach using backward design in their schools, and then we'll have a chance for some questions here at the end. For the board. The primary purpose of the board when it comes to understanding by design approach is vision casting, right? Who are we as a school, right? Because the board is the representatives of the parent community, the parents who are sending their children to this school because they're wanting something out of it, right? They have some vision in mind of what they want for their kids at the end. Right? Now, their vision, the parents' vision, may not exactly line up with your school's vision. But it's the board's responsibility to say, this is what we're trying to do. If you want to come along and be part of this mission, this is what we're trying to do. This is who we are. Right? The board sets that out there. You know, I think if you have like a board retreat or something like that, I think a fun exercise to do there would be to be like, let's spend, you know, 15 minutes coming up with adjectives that we want to describe our graduates. You know, maybe it's words like curious, you know, civically minded. You know, kind. You know, just come up with a bunch of these adjectives saying this is who we want our graduates to be. Because a mission statement is really only so good as like what you can actually produce. You know, what can you actually make people into being? You know, maybe words like poised might come to mind, right? If a goal of your school is that they can speak well, you should want them to be calm under pressure, right? That if people are asking them questions or they're responding difficult, that they're not getting all defensive, that they're able to respond kindly and with compassion and thoughtfulness. You know, and then also I think, you know, in the board, when you're thinking about the administrators that you have, especially your head of school, you know, thinking through really clearly, how do we assess our administrators? How do we know if they're being successful or not at delivering the mission of what we're trying to do? You know, just for example, right, if your core goal as a school, or if you've hired this administrator and you're saying, you know, we need to increase our numbers, we need more students to be able to pay for the facilities we have, et cetera, then how you measure success, if that's kind of your driving thing, is going to look different than if you're saying, you know what, our fundamental thing is we want our students to be holy. That's going to look, the assessment methods we have there are going to look totally different. Now, how do we assess our students being holy? That's a much more difficult question. And so oftentimes it's why we tend to default towards the things that are easier to answer. You know, it's like, oh, we can answer this question, so that will become the thing that we're going to go after. And then for boards themselves, as y'all think about kind of what you're doing at the school, I think it's helpful to think through what are the qualities or the features of this board when it's working well? What does that look like? What's the ethos of the board when things are going well? And then another question I think is a difficult one to think through, but helpful, is how will we know when we're doing well, and how will we know if we're doing poorly? Right? Because sometimes, you know, like if your life is spiraling out of control, oftentimes you're the last person to know. You know, everyone else around you is aware of what's happening, but you're not. But as an internal body, how will you know that things are not necessarily going well, and can you correct them? Right? Because sometimes the earlier you catch things, the easier it is to put fires out. And those are questions that it may be helpful for the board to bring in. I wouldn't do this on a permanent basis by any means, but it might be helpful at that point to bring in some other teachers, parents, et cetera, administrators, to help you answer that question. When we're going well, what does this look like? What does our success look like here? Because then we kind of have some outside accountability in that too. And for administrators, you know, again, I think thinking through, you know, what does the ideal teacher at our school look like? Like, what qualities do they possess? Are they someone who is, you know, a lifelong learner, interested in learning new topics? Are they somebody who is just a real specialist in what they're trying to do? Again, each school, I think, is going to answer these questions a little bit differently. But what does that look like at your school? And can you then help the teachers you have become more like that? You know, target your teacher training to those particular things. If you're like, you know what, we want all of our teachers to know Latin. Develop a Latin course to help them do that. Right? Or we want all of our teachers to know the principles of rhetoric. Is there time in the in-service period where they're learning that? Right? You know, again, these things, it'd be great if all of our teachers knew these things. But if they don't, how can we help them get there? And how do we prioritize those things? What are those things where, like, you know what? This stuff would be great, but you know, it'd be great if all of our teachers were fluent in Greek. Let's pull that back to maybe we'll focus on Latin 1 proficiency for everybody, that type of thing. And then, you know, how do we train and assess our teachers to help them more successfully deliver their content in support of the school's mission? And I think there's two, I would say, ways in which I would recommend approaching this from kind of an administrator perspective. The first is what I would call a principles and practices sheet. I think it would be a fantastic idea for every new teacher you had at your school, maybe by division, you had like a one-page sheet you could give them that said, okay, these are the 4 or 5 core principles about being a teacher at this school, whatever they are. You know, so, for example, on our Europe trip, we have a one-page sheet like this that we give to our chaperones. We say, these are the 4 principles you need to know about being a chaperone. And every single meeting we have with chaperones, we go over these principles. Right? This is what they are. The number one is safety on that principle. You know, safety is our primary concern. Then we say, these are things that good chaperones do that make that principle a reality. These are practices that are done that make whatever this principle we have over here successful. And then there are not practices. Here are things that we have either seen chaperones do or things that we've heard about from other schools. We're saying, these things are not going to be acceptable. These are outside kind of the norm of who we are. So if you think through that for like a new teacher coming into a school, if you're like, here's the 4 kind of big picture principles, here's 3 or 4 things that if you're doing these things, you're moving in the right direction. And here's some things to be avoiding, right? This is moving into the gutter over here. But if they could have that as part of their kind of core teacher training, I think that would help, you know, get them on board with who you are as a school faster. And obviously we know, you know, bringing in new teachers can be a hard thing. It can take a long time to get them kind of up to speed with the culture that that your school has. So I think thinking through kind of a principles, practices, non-practices type of sheet can be a really helpful thing to do. And the other way to maybe think about this is to go back to the kind of the UBD language and think in terms of enduring understandings. Again, you know, things that we've discovered as a school, these are the qualities that good teachers at this school have, the teachers who are successful, who connect with our students, who connect with our parents, who don't have you know, issues of complaining or whatever the concern is, right? They do these things. And then I would also, though, have another section of maybe you call it like common misunderstandings. You know, oftentimes, you know, maybe like I remember when I applied at Regents, 13 years ago, our the head of the upper school at the time was Rod Gilbert, and he told me, and this is clarifying a common misconception. He was like, our students are regular people. Like, they're regular high school kids. They don't come up to me every day and are like, please, may I have more Latin for homework? Okay? They're normal people. They're high school kids. They're not college kids. They're high school kids. They have lives outside of academics. They play football. They play soccer. They're in drama. They do all sorts of things outside of that. So sometimes, you know, if you have a teacher, particularly a teacher maybe who's coming straight to you out of graduate school or something like that, they can sometimes, you know, get so wrapped up in kind of the academic life and think that that's all that there is. It can be real helpful to be like, you know, our kids probably are only going to spend about 30 minutes reading your book a night. That's all they've got because they've got these other classes, they've got these other things going on, and we value those things. We value that our kids are involved in these other things. We want them to be in athletics and drama and music and finance. We want them doing those things, right? So having some kind of list of those kind of common misunderstandings is a helpful thing. It's like we have this, and again, in our humanities handbook, we have a section of these things that we developed as a department. Kind of these are our core understandings, and then these are kind of our common misunderstandings. The most common misunderstanding that kind of everyone said at the same time, and this is, I think, a real good thing to kind of end on here, is that, you know, it's very easy for high school students to think that the person who speaks well is good. It's not the good man speaking well, it's the man who speaks well is good, right? And this is sophistry, right? That's somebody who can just kind of speak in a way that's spellbinding, that's interesting, but what they're saying is actually poison. But that's something as a school, then we have to be, if we know that's a tendency our students have, we have to be actively fighting against that. Right? We have to be actively working to be like, you know what, no, that's not true, and this is why you may have said that really well, but you're actually spreading lies. That's not true. And so that's kind of, I think, a way to think through kind of, again, as a classical school, we want that good man speaking well, but a common misunderstanding, again, among our students is that, well, as long as you say it well, it's all right. And again, we want to fight against that. So I think we've got some time here for questions. Have you got any questions here? Over. Yeah. I would just focus on kind of like, I think always trying to incarnate the ideas are key. Like, if your school has had some graduates, I would think about like, who are some of our best graduates and what qualities did they have? And use that as your guide. And then say, okay, so if we want to get, you know, students who are capable of reading difficult texts well, you know, and can then take ideas and present them or create arguments, you know, those types of things, then how are we doing that further down? But then as a administrator should then take that over at that point, right? The board says this is what we want, then it's the administration's responsibility to go and deliver that and then tell the teachers you need to be helping accomplish these things. Sure. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, so basically I'm summarizing the kind of core textbook of this, which is called Understanding by Design by Grant Wiggins and Jay McTighe, I think is how it's pronounced. Looks like this. You can see we're not allowed to write in these books, so I've marked them up with post-it notes. But this is a fantastic resource. It gets a little academic-ese. At times, like, I mean, they'll spend, you know, three paragraphs describing something that probably could have taken two sentences, just because they get kind of wrapped up in trying to be all things to all people. But I think it's a really helpful thing for Christian schools, especially, though, to think through, because, I mean, you know, we know what we're trying to create, right? We're trying to create students who are disciples of Christ. That's the goal. You know, we've been given that kind of as an assignment through Scripture. You know, that's what our goal is, to train up, you know, children as they should go in the way of Christ. So we know what that should look like. Then there's kind of the nuances about, for each particular school, those kind of particular aspects of things that you know, want to emphasize there. But we have a real particular kind of, you know, vision for who we should be trying to help mold our students into. Yes, it's just called Understanding by Design by Grant Wiggins and Jay McTighe. And then they also have a workbook like this that's got a bunch of like handouts and things. So like here they have like a page about how to like draft essential questions. This one's for literature. But in the original book here, this one here, they've got example, you know, sample lesson plans and that type of thing. Now, they focus almost exclusively on the unit level in their understanding things. They say that's basically the biggest chunk that a kind of a student can kind of wrap their minds around is that. But I think from an administrator and a board standpoint, we need to think bigger picture than that. You know, we need to be asking ourselves, so like when we think about like our theology track at Regents, right? We go Bible, then we do Rhetoric 1, then Apologetics, then Senior Thesis. You know, so in Bible, that's where they're introduced to the Christian worldview, right? And the sources of it, this is what it is. Not necessarily introduced, they get it in other places, but it's explicitly taught in Bible in ninth grade. Then 10th grade, we begin to say, okay, so we've got the good man part, then we move into the speaking well part there, and we look at kind of Socratics and this understanding of kind of the relationship and how do we speak and develop arguments in the kind of the world around us, but particularly in the ancient past. Then apologetics, we take the Christian worldview stuff and combine it with the Rhetoric 1 argumentation and focus upon argument's sake for Christians. And then in thesis, they then move and kind of take that same approach, the Christian worldview and the argumentation stuff they've learned, and now apply it to, you know, maybe it's illegal immigration or global warming or whatever the topic is. But all of that a big picture level, that's what's going on. You know, now the students, they don't see it that way, right? They're seeing each individual tree as they're making their way through it. But I think it's helpful for them, though, periodically to peel back and show them this is where you're going, you know, because they can sometimes get lost in the trees. But our teachers can get lost in the trees, too. Sometimes they also need to kind of be like, this is how this course fits into this bigger picture of what we're trying to do. And the more carefully we can articulate that, the more successful they'll be, and therefore the more successful our schools will be. Any other questions? Okay, great. Well, thank you all very much. I appreciate comments. And you can find me, you know, if your thoughts come to your mind or questions or anything, please, you know, find me over the next couple days. I'll be around. So, thank you.